A specter is haunting the world.
The specter of communism.
Welcome to The Spectre, a podcast of the Communist Party, USA. If this is your first time listening, you can find more episodes, information, and material about The Spectre and the party at cpusa.org. My name is Zach, and for this episode we sit down with Nicole, an organizer with the IBEW and party member. We had the opportunity to talk about what it is like finding and getting into a union, how she became a union organizer, and her experiences in the party. We hope you enjoy. Nicole?
Hi, my name is Nicole. I'm originally from Alaska, but I've been living in Texas for the last 8 years of my life, and I'm currently employed as a staff organizer at my union local with the IBEW, but I'm a waitress and electrician by trade.
Electrician and waitress?
I'm not letting that go. I was a waitress for probably almost 15 years of my life, so I'm a journeyman waitress, too. I'm super proud of that.
Okay.
In a lot of ways, waiting tables is harder than being a construction worker. When I waited tables, I'd be on my feet for 8 hours a day. You don't get real breaks when you're waiting tables. You're still running around. You're still lifting heavy things, carrying heavy things. But as a construction worker, you get rest breaks, and it is important, especially when you're working as an electrician, to be methodical and take your time with things that are, you know, maybe scary or dangerous. You don't want to be rushing through
tens of thousands of volts.
You know, yeah. I'm not a lineman. That's what typically linemen work on really high voltage stuff. But yeah, I mean it's.
Still things.
Definitely dangerous voltage. Yeah.
Yeah, still things that'll give you an unpleasant shock.
Yeah. I'm proud of being a waitress, and, you know, I'd still be a waitress, honestly, if there was a strong union. I took a lot of pride in my job before, thought I was good at it. I like being hospitable. In Texas, the minimum on the check that they pay you, so to say, is $2.13 an hour. And when you work in a tipped position, as, you know, so many people in this country do now, you do get tips, but it's still at the customer's option of whether they pay you for your services or not.
And right.
Sometimes they don't, and I'm not saying that I was starving the whole time, but I didn't have any benefits, I had no job security, there was no room to move up unless you wanted to move into management, which... Let me tell you, don't ever be a restaurant manager. That sounds like a nightmare job to me.
I mean, I've never done anything like that, but just from what you're saying, what I've heard from others, it sounds like a real rough time.
I mean, the power dynamics between you and the customer, it's such a pleasure to me to be hospitable to somebody who wants to come to a restaurant and have a good time and enjoy the company of the people that they're dining with or experience eating a meal prepared for them on their own. It just seems more like increasingly that people go out to eat to just really take out all of their frustrations on wait staff, and you really don't have the option of, you know, standing up for yourself when your customers are giving you hell. You can go, like, if you're getting, like, harassed or something, you can go to the manager, and sometimes you have to do that. And it didn't happen to me a lot of times, but at the end of the day, like I said, your customer has the choice of whether or not they pay you for your services. So if you complain, most of the time you still have to serve them. It's taking time away from tables that do intend on paying you. So oftentimes, my point is, like, sometimes it's just not worth it to even make a big deal about it. But it does beat you down.
Right.
So
what got you into electrical work and becoming an electrician then? And moving up?
Yeah, so... Well, I don't know. Yeah, moving up in the union. So yeah, at a certain point, it's like I was waiting tables, I was getting really burned out on the service industry, I already had a little bit of college under my belt, but I found, here in Austin, Texas, a lot of people come here to go to school and they get bachelor's degrees. And I mean, most restaurants here, the wait staff, most of them already have a bachelor's degree, and that's the job that they were able to find. So to me, it was, I wanted to change careers, but it was daunting thinking about going back to school, spending a lot more money. I was already in a lot of student loan debt. And, adding on to that debt and not having a job when I graduated, a better paying job. So that just got me thinking about, what careers can I pursue that aren't going to drown me even more student loan debt. And I was thinking in my family about the person that we always go to hit up for money. And it's my uncle, who's an electrician, and he has been in the IBEW his entire career. And, like I said, even though I live in Texas now, I'm from Alaska, and growing up, all the men in my family are blue collar workers. And if there's a union for your trade, you're just a part of it. It's kind of just a given. And so anyway, all of my uncles and my dad are tradesmen, and they're all part of their respective unions. My dad's a pipe fitter and a welder, and he was part of the Atomic and Chemical Workers Union, something like that, which went into the steel workers at a certain point. But even my dad said he just would always talk about how he wishes he could be part of the IBEW that he had always heard about. It was just a great union. And so I would have been a union baker if bakers got paid well. So electrician was kind of a secondary factor in becoming an electrician. I wanted to just join the IBEW. Here in Texas, unions are not strong or abundant. So I actually didn't know when I decided I wanted to join the IBEW, become an electrician. I called my uncle in Alaska and asked him how to go about that, because at the time, the apprenticeship program here in Austin didn't even have a website. And this was in 2013. So if that gives you an idea of how far behind they were here. And it was at a point in time where they were in transition with a director and didn't have anyone staffed at the center for a couple months. And, when I was a waitress, I didn't drive a car. I rode my bike or walked or took the bus to work. Nobody would answer the phone. I finally got a hold of the actual union. In the IBEW, the apprenticeship and the union are sometimes different buildings and different staff. I got a hold of somebody at the union. They gave me the number for the apprenticeship center. I called them and nobody was answering. So I got in the car. I rented a car. I drove it to the center, and the doors were shuttered, for a few months. And so it was really a struggle for me down here initially to get into the union and get into that apprenticeship program. But I was determined and finally, got in there, put in my application, and I didn't hear back for a long time. But yeah, I went in and interviewed. I took an aptitude test, and they called me and told me I got in, and I just was so excited, and I cried. I was really excited about getting into the apprenticeship program, because where I'm from in Alaska, there's a line out the door for people who want to get into the IBEW apprenticeship program. It's a really big deal to get in. And so that was my experience getting accepted into the program.
I'm really kind of surprised with a city like Austin and how big it is that it was that difficult to find someone just to talk to.
Yeah, it was perplexing to me too, but I didn't really have any frame of reference at the time. Really had never occurred to me. I was 27 when all this is going down, and honestly, it didn't even ever occur to me until about when I turned 25 or 26 that I thought, oh, maybe I'll learn a trade, because all the people that are in my family who know a trade, they make really good money and have good benefits. I'm from an oil and gas refinery town, and a lot of people from my class, my small graduating class, got into working in the oil field, and they just immediately were making really good money and, you know, buying trucks and stuff, things that I'm not really like into necessarily, but that, you know, where I'm from, that's like,
right, they're buying their toys.
Oh, buying a truck, yeah, buying the toys. So yeah, and I'm just like, if I have health insurance, if I have retirement and I can pay my bills, if I can go get my oil changed in my car, like at this point I'd be ecstatic. So yeah, I started out making $12 an hour. I wasn't exactly rolling in the dough at first, but I figured it out. First year was pretty tough, and you don't have to pay a ton of money to go through the apprenticeship, but there is a little bit of money that you have to pay for books. And at the time, I think it was $545, something like that. And, you know, there's actually kind of this like narrative, and back when I was on Facebook, there was a big narrative about, you know, I was pretty heavily involved in Fight for 15 at a certain point. Yeah, I'm still very supportive of it, but now I organize full time for my union. But when I was really engaging a lot on Facebook about Fight for 15 issues, you get a lot of people who say, if you want to make more money, go work in a construction job, you know, go learn a trade. And it's not easy to just like go and start learning a trade. You have to have a car, and a lot of people don't have cars, and that's a huge expense. You have to make a certain amount of money to even make the car worth it. You have to buy a bunch of expensive tools. You need to, in some cases, buy boots that are safe to wear on construction sites. Apprenticeship costs money, and you can't fill out a FAFSA to pay for that tuition, even though it's a small amount.
Right.
At the time, for me, like, just $545 on top of having to go out and buy a car and tools and what have you, licensing fees and things like that, was... I didn't have $545 laying around. I'm not, like, one of these people that has, like, no support system. And I won't pretend to act like, I didn't have my dad to call and ask for help. And my family did help me out. My partner at the time, his family helped me out, too. But, you know, I started out that first year, and I was looking around, and a lot of the people in my class were young men. There's some older guys, too, but a lot of them were young men who were already married with children. And it got me thinking, like, if it's difficult for me to come up with this $545, I can only imagine how difficult it is for somebody who has multiple mouths to feed on top of their own. And, you know, it got me thinking about accessibility to apprenticeship programs. And back to my point earlier, is it's not easy to just go roll up and start learning how to be an electrician. Those opportunities are not as abundant as a lot of people would think. And especially in the skilled trades have traditionally or historically been a like white male dominated career. Like, the face of skilled trades is changing. I'm a example of that. But like I said before, if you're not plugged into like a trade dynasty, it's not readily available to people. You really have to seek it out. Like I said, I had to like basically beat down the door to get into the apprenticeship program down here.
Oh yeah, absolutely. But, I mean, my father, he's a laborer. My right. uncle was a laborer, and they, funny enough, they worked together all the time. My uncle, he was an electrician with ComEd in Chicago. And so, yeah, you're surrounded by it, but unless you have someone to really kind of guide you through it, you don't really know where to go. And especially those costs, like you were saying, bringing your own tools, getting that nice pair of Red Wings, if you can afford them, like that's a few hundred dollars right there.
Yeah, exactly. So working a fast food job, you don't really need to have a lot of capital up front to start that kind of job. And I've worked fast food before. It's a big reason why I have like a big heart for the Fight for 15. And, you know, the Fight for 15 extends beyond fast food workers, of course. So that pushed me later on when I joined the apprenticeship. We had at the time a probationary period where we weren't able to actually join the union until a year after you had been, or it might have been 6 months or a year after you had start your apprenticeship, you couldn't actually join the union yet. And so, you know, 6 months or a year after I had been in, I was just ready to hit the ground running. I was just super excited to finally be part of a union. I showed up to general body meetings right away. I would say on the top end, 45 people would show up to these meetings, and we're a local about 1,300 people. So I'm not good at quick math, but it's a very low percentage.
Not the biggest turnout. Yeah, not the best ratio there.
Yeah. And I showed up, and it was just, I mean, frankly, it was a retirement home, and there were not very many young people that showed up to the meetings. So me, like, rolling up in there, I already stick out like a sore thumb in the construction industry because I'm like a little woman. So anyway, I showed up, and within the first couple meetings, one of my union brothers, his name is Michael King, approached me and invited me to start showing up to COPE meetings. People who don't know what COPE is, it stands for Committee on Political Education. So I started showing up to these COPE meetings, and me and the group of fellas that were part of COPE decided that we wanted to, we were discussing these issues about accessibility. Everybody in COPE wanted more young people to be getting involved in the union because, you know, I mean, it felt literally like it was dying out. And we needed to get some young blood going in there. And we were thinking about who's going to be up there like running this meeting if we have no young people on deck to take these spots. And we formed into this program. It's a scholarship reimbursement program that we designed together. And basically the way it worked still is in effect now. The way it works is it's $700 now, but you still have to come up with that initial $700 in your first year. It's a five-year program. But throughout the year, if you show up to 7 out of 12 union meetings, we have 12 a year monthly meetings, show up to one more than half of those meetings, well, you got to pass your class too. And if you fulfill 4 activities, and those activities could range from, you know, volunteering for a Habitat for Humanity build a weekend, or, you know, recently in Texas, we had our legislative session. For some reason, the Republican legislators were trying to eliminate electrical licensing. I have no idea why, but none of us did, but it was something that we were obviously trying to fight against. So one of the scholarship opportunities was that there was an action going on, and if members showed up to that action, that counted for an activity. And so anyway, the opportunities to fulfill those 4 activities are abundant, and you have a whole year to do 4 of them. So you pass your class, 10 out of 12 meetings, do the 4 things. You know, at some point during your first year, you got to show up to new member orientation. If you fulfill all those things at the end of the year, the union hands you a check for $700. So you get reimbursed for that books money, and you can turn around and put that money towards the next year. And at the end of 5 years, you get that check, you just put it in your pocket. Really, like, has tackled 2 problems, like, dead on. One is to help ease the cost barrier to people who, you know, maybe don't come from a lot of money, and that's a lot of us in construction. And then also just to give an incentive to these young people to just show up to meetings and just see what it's about and get practice showing up to meetings, getting familiar with Robert's Rules of Order. Hopefully gaining confidence to make a motion at some point. We write out motions on a piece of paper and ask young people to make motions just to get experience talking in front of an audience. I don't like public speaking. I don't think anyone really does, you know, when they first start doing it. But I just remember the first time I made a motion, I was just trembling so much. It was terrible. But at this point, now I'm a staff organizer. I got to speak in front of the local every month. So it's been over 5 years now. So we have had 1 or 2 graduating classes since the program was instituted. And those young people who were part of the program started out like they are heavily involved. We have people from, and this is my class. We have people from my class, like they're at least half of my class is engaged in the union by like serving on committees or chairing committees. I work in the local now. you see them at meetings and they're not, you know, they're not getting paid to be there. So the program really has been like wildly successful. And another thing is the program, like the people who keep track of all the activities that people go to and keep track of how many meetings people go to. So you gotta go and check in after the meeting to verify that you were there. All the people that take care of that are members, and they're young people as well. They're apprentices themselves or young journeymen that take care of the paperwork and stuff related to it. So yeah, it's just it's really exciting. And I try to speak out about it as much as possible because I know every local is dealing with that issue of trying to figure out how to get young people energized about unions and understanding what makes them breathe and grow.
I mean, absolutely. Like, that sounds awesome that you're able to breathe life into this retirement home and get, you know, your own class, half of them into committees and into doing something, and then having classes beyond yours actually continue that tradition and still have this program going. So that sounds amazing that you're able to get that going.
Yeah.
And have it continue. Like, this wasn't like a 2-3 year thing and then we're done. Like, it seems ongoing. I think that's something that we hear a lot from, like I said, from almost every local, is that it's a retirement home, basically, you know, for lack of better words, that
right. Yeah.
People who are going to meetings, who are chairing committees, who are a part of these things, they're up there in their 50s, they're hitting near retirement, and there's no one to come and essentially replace them, no one to train, no one to bring up.
Yeah, I mean, it's almost, it skipped a generation. It feels like it skipped a generation that there was somehow like mentorship for my generation. I'm an old millennial, and even like I'd say Gen X isn't Gen X the generation that's one old, generation older than me?
You want to start talking Gen X, Y, and Z. I don't know which one's which. All I know is that I'm in that millennial range too, and yeah. We are both really pushed to go to college to get this, to get the bachelor's, to get them, you know, to go on. And trades were never really talked about. I mean, in my area, we had our shop classes, and you know, it's, being from Chicago, it's a big union city. So we might be the exception, and you might be the exception as well, being in a strong union town, coming from one. Other areas, like, you know, more broadly speaking, across the nation, that's not it. You know, it's go to college, yeah. And we're starting to see a little bit of that backtrack where joining a union, going into the trades is coming back a little bit, but I guess we'll see the longevity of that, I guess, that backswing.
Yeah, I mean, it's to me, the way I perceive it, it's like a failure of our government planning the need for certain occupations. They left it up to the market. Look what happened. Now we're
really ain't in the market, and poor things happen.
Yeah, we're hurting really bad for skilled. We're hurting bad right now for skilled electricians, for journeyman electricians. We are on the verge of like hemorrhaging retirees, and we don't have journeymen to replace them by and large. So it's a real big issue.
People listening, if you hear that, if you're in Austin and you're looking for a job, you need electricians.
Yeah, we're hoping. I mean, our recruitment strategy has really super ramped up our recruitment strategies over the past year. I'm really proud of our recruiter here in my local 520 office. His name is Mark. He's been doing a fantastic job of getting the word out and going to job fairs.
But you're saying you're an organizer with the union now. So what's that transition been like, going from electrician into organizer? Anyway, has that felt different, or is that something that you kind of just naturally fell into? And what kind of work are you doing now?
As far as naturally falling into it, like I said, as soon as I got into the union, I hit the ground running. I really wanted to get involved right away. I was fortunate to, like I said, be... my brother Michael King reached out to me really early on. So I have been engaged in like pretty active internal organizing ever since I joined my union. And I would say, I think it was maybe in my second or third year of my apprenticeship, and So I guess that would be like my second year of being a union member. I went to a AFL-CIO young worker constituency group, and I actually met one of our comrades, Brett, at that meeting. And I remember that meeting. Okay, I had been flipping through the IBEW constitution, and I saw at the beginning it said that we are against fascism, or we're against Nazism and communism and any other subversive isms or something like that. It says something like that in my constitution. And I was never an anti-communist. I have some like family history that is pretty pro-communist, but I didn't really know what communism was. I guess I just had the idea that it was like great, you know, great in theory, but it didn't work in practice, that kind of attitude. But when I read that in my constitution, it was just, it really perplexed me why would we feel so strongly about being against communism? Like, why that, you know? If it was possible, why the heck would we be against it?
Right.
So anyway, that's the what was on like forefront in my mind when I showed up to this initial meeting, and it was more like a social thing. It was the very first y'all. So y'all is young active labor leaders. It's like kind of it's catchy. So the first young active labor leaders meeting I went to, I was thinking about this thing in my constitution that we were against communism, kind of wondering why that was put in the constitution. And you know, one of our comrades showed up, Brad, and anyway, I was trying to make small talk with people, and I was trying to talk about this thing in my constitution, and most people were just kind of like, you know, didn't it wasn't exactly like stimulating conversation. But Brad showed up a little late actually, and he just like lit up like a light bulb and just started talking to me about McCarthyism, and I forget exactly what he said, like it was a law that they had to put it in the constitution, or, you know, they were pushed to or pressured to or something like that. And anyway, I'd never ever met anybody before in my life who like was knowledgeable or seemingly knowledgeable about communism. And so it really, like, that conversation just really stuck with me. And after that, I'm like famous for the Irish goodbye. I don't like spending a bunch of time saying goodbye to people, so I usually just sneak out. So that, and this meeting was no different. So I snuck out. I didn't get, you know, I wasn't a great organizer at that point because I didn't get anybody's phone numbers or anything, but I snuck out. And later on, you know, I was thinking about that conversation I had with Brad and tried to get a hold of, or I was literally in the process of getting a hold of the chair of Young Active Labor Leaders when I was logged into Facebook and I got a friend request from Brad. So he had beat me to the punch, you know, asking the chair for my contacts. And anyway, he invited me to a meeting, a socialist meeting. And so, you know, I showed up to that socialist meeting, and the thing was engaging fast food workers and going around talking to fast food workers about the Fight for 15 movement. That just totally like made me super excited. You know, I've been a fast food worker before. You know, I worked in food service for a long time. I always wished that I had a union, but I didn't know how unions were built at all. I just knew like if a union exists, you could go join it, but I didn't have any like concept of like building one. But I was really excited about the Fight for 15. That was my first encounter with like socialists, was that we were like practicing like one-on-one conversations with each other, and then like going out and talking with workers. And so that was really like external organizing. That's how I sort of fell into that.
It was those sneaky socialists that got you into
yeah,
got you into all this. Oh man.
Yeah, Brad in particular. I mean, and that, I don't want to like tell his story for him, but he had just gotten done organizing his own like shop. He was working at In-N-Out Burger at the time, and he had organized his shop, and that's how he came into contact with the Fight for 15. And so, you know, I was still an apprentice at the time, still going to school, still working my construction job. But after working on the weekends, I was talking with fast food workers about the Fight for 15 and trying to, you know, move them to action. None of us knew what we were doing. We're just like, you know, just kind of shooting in the dark, so to say. We did have one of our close friends, Kelly, he would spend his own money and fly in and try to like teach us some things and go with us out in the shops and mentor us doing one-on-ones. But I mean, apart from that, like we were just winging it. And so I was doing that for almost 3 years after working on the weekends, and it just gave me a lot of initial experience just talking with workers, understanding how a strike works. So the Fight for 15, their strategy is largely media strategy, but we did actually have a fair amount of successful strikes if you measure success by like getting what they were, by the workers getting what they were demanding. And a lot of the strikes that we pulled were able to organize were for conditions. They weren't necessarily for wages, but for conditions here in Texas. And yeah, I mean, the fastest way for workers to learn about their like power as working class people is to just engage them in like struggle. And that can be as little as circulating a petition at first. One thing we kind of were like learning the hard way is you can't roll up in to a shop and these people don't know you. You know, if I'm talking to fast food workers, you don't roll up into a shop and like the first thing you're asking people to do is go out on strike. You got to meet them where they're at. And sometimes it's like, look, we wrote this nice letter to the boss talking about how much we like working here. We like each other. We like our jobs. But, you know, there's some issues that we have and together we would like to talk about how we address them and sign the petition. That's something that people are like comfortable with starting out. And when the workers see the boss throw it in the trash, that changes them. They don't want conflict at work. Like nobody likes having conflict at work all the time. But when you see like that, just like blatant level of disrespect, it kind of triggers something in people. So it was like volunteering with the Fight for 15. And at a certain point, I got a call from Mr. Michael King, the initial person that reached out to me in the union. And he told me, you know, one of our brothers who we respected decided he wanted to run for business manager. And I got super excited about that because he was another like initial person that I had encountered when I first started coming around the union. He was part of Coke and, you know, he was part of the scholarship program, like development, and just somebody who I thought was more or less on the same page as me as far as what I would like to see moving forward in our local. So that got me excited. He reached out to get me involved in his campaign. And so I hit the ground running, helping him get elected. And we got him elected. It was awesome. And he asked me to apply for a staff organizer position at the local. And I mean, to be honest with you, I was like pretty hesitant at first to apply for the job. It's not like super easy organizing in a union as a young woman when it's a male, like a heavily male dominated industry. And there are a lot of things that I perceived at the time that, you know, and they're still a reality that I thought maybe I wasn't the best fit for the job. But Mike was persistent. He asked me many times to apply for the job and I finally caved and applied for it and I got it. So I've been organizing ever since. That's only a year ago. So I literally got about a year under my belt now.
Even just that, it sounds like all the work you've done before, you kind of fell into a very natural position.
It is something that I'm like familiar with, and it is a lot easier to organize when you're getting a paycheck to do it. Whereas like, you know, for the previous 3 years, I was having to do it after work on weekends. So it's eating up all my free time. And, you know, a lot of the times I would take off work to help with strike lines and things like that. When you're not getting paid a whole lot of money as it is, it's not the easiest to be taken off work. But I'm at this point, I'm just obsessed with organizing. So it kind of gets to be a little bit of an addiction at some point when you're putting yourself at like a financial disadvantage to do it. But so I really can't understate how grateful I am. So I don't take it for granted at all.
So what kind of work are you doing now as an organizer? Like what's been some of your bigger campaigns, or what have you been working on or preparing for, or just what's your day look like now that you're not fiddling with wires and electricity and other dangerous things?
Man, my day-to-day as an organizer, it just changes all the time. The big campaign that I'm on right now is not a It's not like a huge campaign where there's hundreds of employees or anything, but I got a call from a worker who I had encountered at some point. I got a call from him about 5 months ago, and this was a guy that I met him probably 9 months ago, and at the time he wasn't ready to join the union. You know, every month or two I would check in with him, see how he was doing. And then four or five months ago, he reached out to me and said, "Hey, this shop that I'm working at now, my situation here has gone sour. And I was wondering if the, you know, offer was still on the table to join the union." And I got so excited to get that text message. And I met up with him for a drink after work, and we sat down and I just asked him what was going on in the shop. And the thing that was the biggest issue was the workers were not getting paid on time. And I've noticed over the last year that construction workers will put up with quite a lot of abuse. But as soon as you start not paying them on time, that's when mutinies start. And so it was no different in the shop that we're trying to organize now. But at the time, he wanted to just quit that job and come work for a union shop. And traditionally, that has been the bulk of how we have grown the union. It's what we call stripping. We strip workers out of unorganized shops and we send them to work for union shops. And that still is like a good tactic for building the union. We still do quite a lot of that. But something that I have purposefully have been trying to reinvigorate in our organizing department is engaging in actual like organizing campaigns to organize a shop itself, like a non-union shop. And so when I met up with him, his name is Dalton, and he wasn't ready to do any kind of organizing. He just wanted to leave that shop and just put it out of his memory, go on to greener pastures like most people. And I just asked him, I was like, you know, these are a lot of issues that it sounds like you're not the only one dealing with them at this shop. And what would you think about trying to stay where you are, fight where you stand instead of retreating? And that language I've been trying to use to motivate these guys to make change, and I've tried to turn it into a negative thing to kind of run away from their problems instead of just like staying where they are, staying put. So yeah, I was like, well, you're going to run away from your problems, you're going to retreat. Why don't you stay and talk with other people? Maybe they want to have better conditions. And, you know, this place is like totally ripe for a union campaign. And I was just jumping out of my pants, like excited about this prospect. And he was pretty hesitant at first, not going to lie, but I was like really persistent about him not running away from the problem. And he came around a lot quicker than I think he probably thought he was going to. And that has blossomed into quite the organizing campaign. So I had that initial meeting with Dalton. He then agreed to be talking with his coworkers, not blasting the issues, you know, talking with the union out to everybody. But, you know, we started out by doing what's called a power map of his shop. And that's where you talk about all the workers there and how you perceive affinity to the idea of a union, how long they've worked for the company, you know, if they're tight with the boss or not. We started out with that and we picked a few people to talk to. And in the meantime, I told them, I know this seems scary right now because you're the only one coming to me and talking about these issues. You know, he, of course, first thing they think about when they think about forming a union is, am I going to get fired? And I was just completely honest with them from the get-go. Yeah, you're probably going to get fired. Like, I'll just say it now. It's not if your employer is going to retaliate, it's when. They will retaliate at some point. We just don't know when.
Right.
And my job is to give you the tools and the strategy to win despite that retaliation, give you the tools and weapons to use when that happens. And we, you know, beat them at their own game. So, yeah, I was like, you're going to get fired, and it's not a terrible thing if you get fired. And we have ways of combating that. But, you know, I just started out talking with him about his rights, his Section 7 and 8A rights. Sadly, one of the biggest things in our country that people think is legal but isn't. People think that your boss can fire you for forming a union. Or they can retaliate for talking about organizing, or, you know, it's called concerted activity. Everybody in the United States of America has Section 7 and 8A rights under the NLRA, and no at work, a right to work or whatever, or at-will employment trumps those. Everybody has them. So that in itself is something you got to talk to workers, especially in Texas, about. And to give you an idea of how difficult it is to like beat this into people's heads is I've literally sat down with people, gone on the government website and shown them their rights, and they still will go back and read their contracts that may say you can't talk to the union, you can't give out any information about your pay, or you know, whatever kind of violation of the NLRA is in those contracts, and they'll look at that contract and still think that I can't be talking to you, I'm going to get fired, and they're going to have every right to sue me, you know, when they find out. So I spent quite a lot of time talking to him about his rights and just building up his trust and his faith in me, leading him through it. The only thing I have is my credibility. So I have to make sure that I'm telling these workers things that I can follow through with and not giving them any kind of like false expectations. So, you know, when he initially said that he was afraid of getting fired, I was very, you probably will get fired and that's okay. You know, it's not the end of the world. It's especially not the end of the world. And this is a benefit to being a construction organizer is if somebody does get fired, there's no shortage of construction jobs that you can go out and get like literally the next day or maybe even the same day. We're fortunate right now to be living in a city in a part of the country where construction is booming. And yeah, there's no shortage of jobs. So that's not so much the case if you work at like a nuclear power plant or something like that. It's like more of like a maintenance position. Getting fired from one of those jobs, not like you can just go down the street and get another nuclear power plant job. Another thing I was telling him is, I know this is scary right now and it feels like you're all alone when you go back to work. You're the only one fighting this fight, but I have members of the union already that are totally ready to come in and support you. And I'm going to, you know, have them apply to work here. They're called SALTs. I'm going to have them apply and they're going to be helping you and supporting you along the way. And so you'll feel like you have a team here. So for anybody who doesn't know what assault is a worker who goes and gets a job intentionally to organize that workplace. It doesn't mean that you don't need that job. It just means that you're going to go get that job and also be actively trying to organize it into a union. That was our next step is, you know, we picked one person from the shop that he felt comfortable to talk to about it. And I got to work on contacting members who said they wanted to get involved and grow the union. And I was able to send in a couple salts and we met up. And then that was the kickoff of the campaign. We just slowly started talking to workers and it's called inoculating them, talking to them about their rights, giving them kind of an explanation about probably what the course of events would be, how the boss is likely to retaliate when that happens, what can we do about it. When I was talking to Dalton the first time and he was worried about getting fired, sure enough, at a certain point, he did get fired. And we kind of felt that a firing was imminent, so we made sure that we came out like very open about his concerted activity. Concerted activity sounds like a fancy word. It just means when two or more workers engage in discussions about improving their workplace conditions, whether their wages or conditions, that constitutes as concerted activity. And there's a lot of activity that's concerted activity that we wouldn't readily think is organizing activity. I help train workers on picking out is we're so used to getting our rights trampled upon all the time that we don't realize when it happens. But if we aren't able to identify unfair labor practices and file charges and hold our bosses accountable, there's not going to be any consequences and they're going to continue to do it. And it does impede organizing activity. So that's a big part of what I do on a day-to-day basis, especially in this campaign. When we felt like a firing was imminent, what I did is I just like went ahead, got on my computer and emailed their boss, exhaustive list of all the people that were supportive of the union and let them know that the union is here. If you want to come talk to us, it's not the end of the world. And in fact, it can be a great thing to be a union workplace. You know, your employees don't hate working with each other. They enjoy doing the work as much as you can enjoy going to work. But they, you know, there's some things that they want to improve about their workplace and they'd like to be able to sit down and talk to you about it like equals. And, but anyway, here are all the people, here are their names and they're going to be organizing before work and during their breaks and after work and have a good day. So what that did is a lot of people, I think their instincts when they want to organize is to whisper and like hide in the shadows and keep it super secret the entire time. And while that is important when you first engage in a campaign, you can't organize a union in secret, not the whole time. When you're first in there and you're doing your reconnaissance work, your information gathering, you're doing your initial conversations with people who you feel are pretty supportive, yes, you want to do that in secret. But the problem is, like I said, it's not a matter of if your employer will retaliate, it's when they're going to retaliate. And if we're going to hold them accountable to the law and file unfair labor practice charges when that happens, if Dalton would have never had some like blatant evidence that his boss knew that he was organizing, so if he at no point like outwardly said anything, at no point he wore a union supportive t-shirt or had a, you know, sticker on his hard hat or had a recording of him talking about it in front of one of his bosses or something like that, when we go to file an unfair labor practice, the NLRB is going to ask us, well, what proof do you have that that's why he fired him? And if we have nothing to show for it, it's like, well, the boss is like 100% going to come back and say, I don't know, he was organizing a union. And then we've lost our case and that guy's out of a job. And, the campaign takes a big hit when people get fired. So when Dalton got fired, we filed an unfair labor practice. And the boss was pretty clear to me very early on that he had no idea that workers had rights. And so he gave us a lot of like ample opportunities to teach him about the NLRB or the NLRA. And after Dalton was fired, we also were able to file charges for like managers, interrogated a bunch of employees about whether they were supporting the union, meeting with me and signing authorization cards. And another one was like, we flat out caught them recording concerted activity, like spying on the workers. That was pretty clear cut case too. The thing is, like, we did do a lot of inoculation initially when we were still in secret and when the lid blew open. We had already been engaging in our campaign for a long time and the boss was really late to start his campaign. Another great thing that was in our corner is Dalton. He's just a really hardworking young man. He's beloved by his coworkers. They know him to be somebody who takes his job seriously. He's just like a really likable dude. And so when he was fired, that just really didn't sit right with most of the people that work in that shop. And so all kinds of people who work in that shop were ready to hear about what was going on with this campaign. And after he got fired, we met that day during lunch. We had some other workers come and meet up with us during lunch. They were kind of fed up with what was going on in the shop, and Dalton getting fired was kind of the last straw. They signed cards. So in a lot of ways, like Dalton getting fired was just really ammo, you know, for us. But yeah, Dalton, like I said, it wasn't a big deal when he got fired. He didn't panic at all. Found him a union job the next day. He was getting paid more than $5 more an hour at this union job. He was working the whole week that he was fired. And in the meantime, I was able to negotiate a reinstatement of his job and full back pay by the next Monday. So he was out of work for a week. I negotiated with the attorney that the shop went out and hired. We got him back to work, got him a nice fat back paycheck. And that really, it showed the workers that the union's not going to get punked out that easy. And, you know, and I was able to follow through on my word that I told a lot of these guys, it's not the end of the world if you get fired. They need us way more than we need them right now. We're in a really great spot as far as organizing goes in that there are way more jobs than there are workers. At a certain point, we had enough card signs to submit a petition for an election. You need 30% of authorization cards, 30% of the workers in the particular workplace to sign authorization cards. If we can only get 30% of workers to sign an authorization card, that's not really good prospects for us as far as winning an election. So we like to get way more than 30%. In fact, we shoot for 70 to 80% of people signing cards before we even go to petition the NLRB for an election. But yeah, and an authorization card is really all it's saying is that, at the very least, all it's saying is that, yes, I would like the choice to vote of whether or not I have the ability to sit down and negotiate with my employer. So as far as like workers winning a union in their workplace, like we're at a point where you really have to build up a campaign 3 times before you get an actual union, because first you got to get those cards signed. That's a big feat in itself. Then you got to go and apply for the petition. If you don't have a union already with like a professional organizer helping you out, it's not that easy to just know how to go about doing any of this. The NLRB is very helpful if you know that they exist, if you know who they are, and if you have any kind of like iota of understanding about unions, you can kind of navigate a little bit through it. But like I said, there are a lot of people in Texas that don't even know that unions are a thing. But anyway, yeah, you got to get all those cards signed, then you got to go and do the petition. You have to have people hang on long enough to even make it to the election. Because, I mean, even in this campaign, we had nearly half of the shop just quit during the campaign. It was just too stressful for them. So, I mean, we lost a lot of like support, you know, just in people quitting and going, like I said, just what I think of is retreating and going and taking a different job. So yeah, hanging on long enough and actually, you know, if people are able to go in and win a vote, that's two times you've had to prove that you want a union. And even once you win that vote, it doesn't win you a union. It wins you the ability to sit down and negotiate with your employer. And that process, there are a lot of tricks and loopholes that if you don't have an organizer or really a labor attorney that knows their NLRA, you probably will not be able to even sit down and negotiate a contract because there's so many ways that an employer can wiggle out of even a negotiation. And so hopefully that third attempt, you sit down and you negotiate a decent contract, but it's pretty incredible to me that unions even are like born. The law is not written in our favor at all. And then compounded with the like cultural differences, even for, you know, where I'm from, like I said, if there's a union for your trade or your industry, you just join it. It's like, of course you want to join it because you have a voice in the workplace, you got better wages and conditions, you don't question it too much. Down here, people look at, if they know what a union is, it's most of the time they're like against it or treat it with suspicion. So, you know, there's just especially in Texas, there's just a lot of things working against us. So it's pretty incredible when you do hear about unions forming, people winning their contracts.
Yeah, I think that kind of goes back. When we first started talking, it seemed very positive, like, unions have strength, we can do this, the workers have rights, go forward, do something. And then you start organizing, you start trying to do something, and you're like, oh, they can do this, they can do that.
You right. need it's a little more complicated.
Yeah, you need to get your own, use yourself a nice slick labor lawyer to help you out. You gotta you set sign cards 2, 3, 4 times if you have to.
And we're fortunate here in Austin, Texas with IBEW, we have who I consider to be the best labor attorney in the state of Texas, and he happens to be my mentor as well. So, and he himself has an incredible story. He started out, I believe, as like a road construction laborer. Somebody approached him actually in a Narcotics Anonymous meeting, and they said, like, you're a smart person, you should go apply to the apprenticeship program with the IBEW. He did it. He started school, he went through the program, he got his journeyman status, and he immediately began his career as a staff organizer. He learned so much about labor law being an organizer with our local that he decided to go to law school. So now he's a labor attorney, and he's a damn good at one at that. And he's ours, so.
Yeah, even better.
Yeah, I mean, all the unions around here and all around the state and even in our district, which stretches beyond Texas, utilize his knowledge and expertise. So really my point to all that is if you don't know labor law, like the back of your hand, and you don't have access to an attorney, you could pretty much like kiss any union effort goodbye. If you do, if you're listening and you want a union, figure out which union, you know, is most suitable to whatever industry you're in and give them a call, because no union is going to be perfect, but any union is better than no union when you're trying to organize your workplace. I just couldn't imagine just going out lone wolf, like trying to organize a union without any existing union resources. So
this is a good just transition to like how would someone go into finding a union, or who should they contact, or yeah, what would you suggest to someone who isn't in a union, who's unorganized, who's interested? Like, what steps do you think they should take and how should they prepare for that process?
Okay. Well, if I was a worker and I didn't have a union in my workplace, my suggestion as a now professional organizer is, I'd say at first is to kind of gauge the temperature of your workplace to see if you're the only person in your workplace that is like, you know, has, now let me start this over. If I was a worker in a workplace who didn't have a union already, I would be careful about being outspoken about it first. So, like I said before, you can't organize a union in secret. At some point, you got to be open because you have to prove that when you're retaliated against, that your boss did it because you were organizing. But, yeah, so I'd keep it hush-hush at first. And honestly, I would say as soon as you can, figure out what union would be most suitable to your industry. And a way you can do that is by contacting the AFL-CIO in your area. And that's sort of like, that's the umbrella organization over all the unions. That would be a good organization to get a hold of, and they can kind of gauge which union would be most suitable. And try to get a hold of an organizer, because, like I said, you will get retaliated against at some point, and you don't want to go into it flying blind. You want to be, like, armed going in. You got to be thinking about it as like going into battle. And, you know, if you don't have any weapons, if you don't have an army, you're going to lose. And so, yeah, try to get a hold of somebody that can give you some guidance, give you some tools, teach you about the law, so you can have access to resources. Yeah, that's my suggestion. That's kind of long and short of it. Probably not as elaborate as you want.
Any suggestion is a good suggestion, right?
Okay, here's another thing, though. Okay. Say you're in an industry and you're like, I don't know, you're working at a Target somewhere, and you want to form a union, and you call up the AFL-CIO, and they say, you know, contact SEIU, and then you contact SEIU, and, you know, they're not getting back to you. Or they don't have an organizer, you know, available. Understand that unions are struggling right now. We are working at rebuilding them, and not every local union has the resources, unfortunately, to, you know, tackle every single fight that comes to them. So we don't unfortunately have the resources to throw to everybody's campaign. So sometimes it's good to be like talking, you know, like I said with Dalton, that I suggested to Dalton, like think of one person in your workplace that you feel pretty safe about talking with the union about. Start with that person. But understand at some point, like, people gossip. Construction workers are the biggest gossips I ever met in my life. Word will get out eventually, but, you know, start and see if there's like, test the temperature a little bit, you know. But if it's the case that you can't get any unions to really back you up, and I know Brad had this issue when he was having issues at In-N-Out Burger, there were like no unions that had resources to help him, or, you know, it's not necessarily because we don't want to, it's like we just don't have endless resources. But what you can do is, if you're interested in organizing a workplace, you can also ask the union, hey, do you have any campaigns going on? Active campaigns going on that I can help with. And if your highest priority beyond putting food on your table and getting a paycheck is organizing, you can be a SALT. So you can be a worker that gets a job with the intention of organizing. So my point is, don't get down if a union doesn't jump on the opportunity right away to help you organize. But if you're willing to change jobs, there could be organizing opportunities already, you know, available.
All right. I mean, that's,
yeah.
I think that's, you know, a good suggestion as any, you know, just to look at all your options, you know, and reach out to the resources that, or the people who have the resources to really tell you what's going on or what you can do. Now I'm going to kind of jump back a little bit. I wanted to hop on that while we're kind of on the topic of, like, what you should do. I know we talked before about talking about what's like being a woman in the trades and what difficulties have you faced, what problems have kind of come up that you've experienced. Because, like I said, you touched on these before. Historically, it's been a very white male-dominated field. Even through the 50s, almost, it was basically segregated as well. Like, it's been a very kind of exclusive field. So what's been your experience as a woman in all of this?
My experience as a woman... Yeah, I don't think my experience as a woman in the trades is that much different than most women's experience in the trades. You're oftentimes, like, I would go sometimes years without having any women at work. You know, when you get so used to just being around men all the time that, like, I'd hear a woman's voice and it was like, you know, the customer would be on site or, like, an architect or a safety person or something would be on site and I'd hear a woman's voice and it was just like... My ears.
Where did it come from?
I was just looking around for her, you know. Yeah, where is she? Yeah. I mean, I at one point was on a job site with like literally 600 construction workers. I was literally the only tradeswoman on site. It was an Apple complex here in Austin. Being a woman in the trades, I feel like I've answered this question so many times and. Mine's going blank right now. I think people initially, like the thing that comes to people's minds immediately is like the issue of sexual harassment. And sexual harassment is a real thing, you know, a real challenge in the trades. But if I'm being completely honest, I experienced just as much sexual harassment working as a waitress. And mostly from customers, not always, you know, from my coworkers. As a server, most of the time I worked in restaurants, I actually worked with mostly women, and I had a great, like, working relationship with most of them. But yeah, sexual harassment is an issue. The benefit, I would say, in a lot of ways, dealing with sexual harassment at work as a construction worker is I do have some recourse. Whereas, I can go and make a complaint and honestly, if I made a complaint every single time I got sexually harassed at work, I would spend my whole time like filing sexual harassment complaints. So you have to pick your battles, and you have to have thick skin. You have to let some things, you have to brush some things off and not dwell on every little issue that comes up, but. You know, when you're waiting tables, a lot of it will come from your customers, and if you don't just eat it, you might not get that tip, and then you're not paid, and a lot of the time your managers are not super supportive when you complain about it. So, I remember when I was a server, as much as I did love my job in a lot of ways, I felt like almost every shift I would come home and have something to complain about. And I'd kind of stew on things that happened at work or, you know, customer said something stupid to me or whatever. In construction, you know, in all the challenges that I've had as a woman in construction, I never brought any kind of negativity home. I was able to just really, like, clock in, clock out, and think about work. And I did, so it didn't, like... The issues I faced at work didn't really stew with me so much, but that isn't to say that my experience hasn't been like full of frustration and tears and anger. I mean, probably the biggest things that come to mind are just loneliness. For me, I like to talk at work. I work and talk, and just talk the whole time and not work anything or work. But I enjoy the company of women. I like speaking with women. I like the company of men, too. I like speaking with men. But, yeah, if you're a construction, there's, like, barely any women around. And whereas before, I made a lot of friends at work. I haven't been able to make as many friends at work, and it's not because I don't like people that I work with, but there's a lot of, like, I'll hit it off with male coworkers, but they, a lot of them are in relationships where they're not allowed to have female friends, and so, you know, well, it's not uncommon that I'll have, like, a buddy at work, and we just have a great working relationship, and I might see him and his family at the grocery store, and I might as well be a tree or a post office box or something. I'm just like, my existence is, like, not acknowledged at all.
Right.
They just, and unfortunately, like, for one reason or another, like, have jealous wives or, you know, so that's a reality for me, is just,
I mean, it speaks to our culture as a whole a lot too. It's just that you can't have these, or you're not supposed to have these relationships with other sexes, right, like, at all. And it boggles my mind, and I'm sure it boggles yours and a lot of other people's minds, where, like, I get along fine with this person. Like, we talk. Like, why is there this forced barrier between us conversing outside of work or outside where we normally see each other?
Yeah. Out of all the things that I feel like have been the most challenging for me, is just not being able to have as many friendships with my coworkers. Because, you know, like, most all of my friendships have been built at work. So that's probably the biggest thing. And at a certain point, I got into just listening to podcasts at work. So I would just download hours and hours of podcasts, because on most jobs, it's frowned on to have, like, your earbuds in listening to music, but a lot of us do it, and especially, like, young people will listen to music or podcasts or the radio. But that's kind of something I just do to keep my mind stimulated. If I didn't necessarily, like, click with people at work, the culture, you know, I grew up raised by my dad, and he's a tradesman. You know, I've lived with my dad and my brother for a long time, so it's not that I'm not used to being around tradesmen or, you know, men in general. But I'll never fit in completely with their culture, and so I just had kind of accepted that. It doesn't mean I don't love them all. I don't like them all, but so just like not just being a part of the culture, it's still a very homophobic place to be, and I'm a bisexual woman, so that's something I just have to be patient about. You just really have to pick your battles when you're kind of like someone who sticks out and it maybe isn't exactly like all the others. When you're a woman in the trades, like, an issue that a lot of us encounter is not having personal protective equipment that fits us properly. So, and that's like gloves that don't fit your hands. Like, a lot of the times they just don't have size small on hands. There's just not a lot of people who wear smalls, so they don't buy them in bulk. Or your, like, safety vests are gigantic and cumbersome to work in. It's difficult to find, like, construction clothing that fits well. If you do, it's oftentimes really expensive. Tools are not built for small hands, so, like, getting, like, arthritis and, like, tendonitis is pretty common. But, and, you know, there's also, like, a big issue about the bathroom issue. You have, like, for instance, I mentioned that job site with 600 men. You got 600 men, all the porta cans are going to be used by people who, like, are peeing all over the place. Sometimes people literally, like, shit on top of the porta can lids. I mean, they're construction workers can be pretty gross, and when you're a woman, you need to, like, you need to sit down to use the restroom, and we have periods, and sometimes there's not even, like, hand washing stations, and I've never seen a man, like, call OSHA about, like, health standards. And so, like, a lot of these complaints about, like, not having hand washing stations or not getting, you know, porta cans clean frequently enough, it comes from, like, the women on the job site. We're not as, like, ashamed to, like, complain about issues like that, but it makes us, I already stick out on a job site, so if I'm complaining about things, even if they're, like, completely valid complaints. It just makes me more the odd one out. But in a lot of ways, too, like statistically speaking, job sites with women on them are safer job sites because of that. We don't have like toxic masculinity that we have to deal with where we have to prove our manhood so much that we work on dangerous or unsanitary conditions. You know, if we complain about it, we're not man enough. Like, I'm a woman. It's very obvious that I'm a woman. I don't have to prove to anybody that I'm a man. In some way, you know, there's like, if you want to like see the silver lining and things, I'd say that's one. But a lot of the issues that women deal with in the trades are not unique to women. It may affect us more acutely, but the trades are like not a healthy place for anybody to be in. Working with your body in construction, it breaks it down. You really have to take really good care of yourself to prevent injury. Exercising and stretching is obviously a good idea. And people who take good care of their bodies tend to be able to work with them for much longer. But even people who are in really good shape take care of their bodies. Walking up and down a ladder is really hard on your knees, especially if you're carrying heavy things. Getting knee replacements is a really common thing. And guys and you know, women too, in their 40s, you'll see them getting knee replacements. And back injuries are common. And injuries in general are common in construction. And they're actually in the last Electrical Worker, that's the publication my union puts out on an international level. The front page article was about how construction has the highest opioid addiction problem. Like, out of all the trades, we have like, you know, two or three times as many people addicted to opioid. And, you know, they don't solve the underlying problem. Construction, like paid sick leave, is not heard of for the most part. Even cities who do have paid sick ordinances, a lot of them, the construction industry is exempt from them. So say you get an injury at work, and especially if you're a non-union worker, you get an injury at work, maybe you have health insurance, maybe you don't. If you do, most likely it's really expensive to begin with and you opt out of it. But if you get hurt, well, these injuries follow you your entire life. I hurt my back. I herniated a disc in my back when I was waiting tables. And as a construction worker, that issue followed me. And, you know, it's not an injury that I got at work, so it's not a workman's comp thing. So if I'm out of work and I don't have paid sick leave, I got a light paycheck, and that's really difficult. Puts you in a place where you have to, you know, choose between paying bills or go to the doctor or, you know, working with an injury is the worst thing you can possibly do. Yeah, so a lot of these issues that I've dealt with, like setbacks, they're not really that unique to women. It's not a super welcoming place for women. If we're all being honest about it, construction is not a super healthy profession for anybody. I'd say being an IBEW electrician, I have a lot of privileges of being part of this union, and we've been able to fight for better conditions than a lot of trades. But it is still a very dangerous job, regardless of whether you're in a union or not, and it's always getting safer, but...
Right. So, and it sounds like that just both culturally and structurally, there's just a lot of issues that you need to contend with.
Right.
And so even speaking towards just the danger in and of itself, the hardship that is being a laborer, that's why, you know, in other places that have a more worker-focused mindset, laborers, they're working 4, 5, 6 hours a day instead of the 8 or 10. I know one example in particular, which will be a good transition into what I want to cover next. Back in the old Soviet Union, if you were a laborer, if you worked in the mines, or if you were a steel worker or anything like that, you only worked 4 or 6 hours a day. You only worked for like 4 days a week. You got top privileges to go to spas and vacation places and the beach and really anywhere you wanted to go because you had the most demanding work. Whereas if you were an office clerk, you work your 8 hours, 5 days a week, middle of the rung. So one thing I did want to ask is that you are by no means a secret member of the party. So how is being a socialist, how is being a communist really kind of affected your outlook in organizing and in the work you do? And has that caused any issues, or has that made some of your work a lot more rewarding and inspiring to do?
Well, I'm an open communist in my union local in the state of Texas.
That just sounds like a trifecta of like, oh no. Like, McCarthy's just spinning right you now, know, and he's just...
I'm really torn between saying, like, we should be open and saying, like, you know, it's better not to be open. The way it shook out for me, the way it shook out, I'm an open communist. There's no turning back now. They got photos. So I've just, and I wasn't like found out to be a communist. I am a very like hard-headed person when I first, like when I first started learning about communism. So like I said, I had met Brad. He was the first person that really like talked about communism a lot with me. But, you know, like I had my Spanish teacher in high school, often went to Cuba, and when she'd come back, she'd talk to us about Cuba, and she talked to us about their system and how it wasn't as terrible as, you know, government media make it out to be. And she'd talk about the positive things about their system. And my best friend in high school, she's 3 years older than me. When she graduated, she went to Cuba and came back and was telling me about all the, you know, beautiful things about that country. And obviously they have a lot of poverty too, but it really just made me think more about, it's like, it's not a boogeyman. My own grandmother she's Filipino, and she was in the Philippines during the Japanese occupation during World War II. And her family, the ones who made it out, fled into the jungle and were protected by communists during that time. And so I'm fortunate that not all of my idea about communism has been negative, but it really is force-fed to us in the United States. So just like here in Texas, like kids are brought up thinking unions are bad because you get it at school, you get it from your parents, you get it in your community. And that just like that brainwashing indoctrination is really difficult to overcome. But yeah, so I came from a pretty fortunate perspective that I was willing to give it a chance, like at least learn about it and try to make an informed opinion. And I was lucky enough to find somebody or to meet somebody who had a decent level of expertise about what they were talking about as far as communism goes. But when I started learning about it, it was really exciting to me because it wasn't like I was reading about things that were like brand new. I was reading about things, and it was putting scientific terms to things that I was experiencing in my everyday life and that I had already been thinking about. I just didn't have like a scientific way of thinking about it. Like, for example, like the labor theory of value. That I remember, like when I first learned about that, it was like one of the first things I was reading about. It was just so exciting to think about that in, you know, a scientific way, because I had been, as a first year apprentice, I was sent to a prefab shop, and they had me prefabbing electrical panels. And that's actually like pretty uncommon for first year apprentices to do, but usually you do them. Well, it's just uncommon, but when you have the opportunity to do them in a panel shop, this is kind of a brand new thing that they've been able to like put it more in a factory setting. They put me on that job. You know, one thing that I didn't mention about what women, how we struggle in the trades is we have to do things like twice as good as a man to be taken seriously. And so me starting out especially, I did like go above and beyond to prove myself that I could hack it in the trades. One of the ways that was is when I got this panel assignment, hundreds of panels that had to be done. And when they put me on this job, I was with some other guys, and I was the fastest at doing these, and my work was the neatest, and I was doing them in half the time as everybody else. And when I got to thinking about it, I was doing them, you know, during lunch. Our boss used to like sit with us in the break room and eat lunch. And one day I asked him, like, how much do you guys charge for one of these panels? Like, how much do you charge the customer? And he told me they charged them 4 hours at a journeyman's rate. And I got to thinking, like, well, I'm an apprentice and I'm making 50% of a journeyman's rate and I'm doing them in 2 hours. So I was just thinking about like all that amount of profit that they were making on every panel, because I was just like blowing through these panels And like, meanwhile, everyone's resenting me because I'm like, you know, doing things twice as fast for the same amount of money. And it's like, you know, raising the expectation for everybody else. But, you know, I was going home, you know, I was doing like, you know, I do like three and a half panels a day. And at night, like my forearms just started and my hands would just be aching from doing those repetitive motions all day. Anyway, I mean, it just really got me thinking about it. It's like, well, that's not fair. Like, I'm doing all these extra work and I'm not seeing an extra penny of like any of this profit. Like, why the hell am I?
Yeah, you're doing like a fourth of what they're selling it for. if my quick math is right, that's like a fourth. Twice the rate at twice as many.
I'll take your word for
it. Yeah, sure. Yeah, why not? We'll go with it. Yeah. Someone can correct me later.
Yeah, it was just like kind of made me raw about it. And it wasn't that I just, suddenly like slowed it down or anything like that, but a little bit. And you're just like working in like a factory setting and get really bored. And in some ways, like, I get depressed doing the same things over and over. I probably wired 300 panels easily during that first year I was in that prefab shop. But yeah, but anyway, that was, you know, when I started learning about communism, it was like labor theory of value. It wasn't like, oh, I read about this in a book and, you know, I learned about it. It was like, oh, I already know workers. Like, that's something that when I talk to workers about, when I talk to them about, like, the science behind it, it's not hard for workers to grasp at all. Like, it's, you know, they take to it like a fish to water. So that was, like, exciting to think about is labor theory value. And I guess, like, my point is, like, learning about communism was just, I was so excited about it and I just wanted to learn more and more. And I one of the early like communist texts that I read was Reform or Revolution by Rosa Luxemburg, and that was also very appropriate for what I was doing, as she talked a lot about the limits of unions in that text. And it was something that I'd already been thinking about, is like, even if we organize 100% of electricians into the union, what if I'm working in this factory and every 100% of us are in the union, and so we basically run shit, and our demands, you know, in my opinion, like, the demands can never get really that high. I mean, I think like most demands are righteous. So but what if we ask for so much that the boss, like, they up and decide, like, you know what, screw this, we're not doing our manufacturing here anymore, we're going to go to some other country where the workers are not organized. So, you know, sucks to be you guys, but now you're out of a job. So it's like, what do you do? You know, the union can't prevent that, not in a legal sense anyway. So then what, you know? And that's a reality that we're facing. It's not kind of like, oh, what if that happened? That happens all the time.
Yeah.
I mean, we could see in Chattanooga, I think, you know, I think it was a VW plant that they were trying to organize. That's like a, I think, like a valid, you know, fear that a lot of workers have, is if I join this union, we're going to ask for too much, and then they're going to, you know, VW is going to go somewhere else and give these jobs to people that aren't asking for so much. It got my brain churning, and yeah, these are questions I was already asking myself, and like, I was seeing them in black and white, and it's like, I just, the more I read, it was like an awakening almost. And I was just so excited about the stuff that I was learning. And also at the same time, just like kind of angry that I felt kind of lied to my entire life about communism, and frustrated by like media and things like that. And so I was just like, I'm like an evangelical communist. I can't help it. And of course, you know, I'm at work 40 plus hours a week. Like, those are the people I talk to all the time, are my coworkers, are the construction workers. And, you know, at a certain point, it's like, it didn't really ever occur to me to be a secret communist, I guess.
And I mean, if you're being evangelical about it, then of course, like, you're spreading the good word. You're having a field day.
But yeah, it's like I'm reading about this stuff. It's like describing exactly what I am experiencing in a scientific way. This lady, you know, maybe you can chime in here. I forget when Rosa Luxemburg wrote Reform or Revolution, but it was a long time ago.
We can say 100 plus years. You know, I'm not going to look up dates right now.
This woman is writing about stuff over 100 years ago that is like completely coming to fruition in this day and age. So it's like, she called it, and you can't argue with facts here. The media is just like, yeah, I read about this stuff, and like, yeah, communism isn't really crazy, and this is why. And it's just like, I was just really excited about it. I mean, for better or for worse, like I said, construction workers are by and large men, and men are some of the most gossipy lot that I've ever worked with. And so there are a lot of people in my union who know me to be a communist. And now, like, I've had to face a lot of hard realities that people jump to conclusions when they hear communism. And so, you know, there are people who, like, hear about the fact that I'm a communist and have, like, negative impressions. And unfortunately, I never get to meet these people. It's just, like, kind of gossip behind my back about it. But if I'm ever able to, like, talk with my coworkers one-on-one about it, it's, like, especially if I'm talking without using, like, crazy, you know, unrelatable, alienating words, which is easy for me to do because I don't really know those words very well.
Right. Or even just the scary words, like saying, like, you can talk about communism without saying communism, and they'll agree with you.
Yeah, yeah. It's just working class politics. So, you know, one thing that I thought a lot about was, you know, the fact that I think that we need a labor party would really catch on in the state of Texas, because a lot of us, myself included before, thought about Texas as like, oh, it's a big Republican state. Most people vote Republican in Texas. But the reality is, like, by far the biggest voting population are non-voters. And actually a very small percentage of Texas actually votes Republican. So it's not accurate at all to say that Texas is a Republican state. It's just unfortunate that the majority of people who vote are Republican. But most working class people that I encounter, especially in my union, they don't vote at all. They don't feel like there's a party that really represents their interests. And a lot of people just feel frustrated and lied to all the time. So like one thing I really like talking about at work is like forming a labor party or workers party, and be like a membership party where you pay dues, and so our money's not swimming around with Wall Street and big banks and pharma, and our candidates aren't, you know, being bought off by any particular interest besides our interests.
Of course.
And, you know, we can vote on who the candidates are, and we can vote on, you know, what our policy platform is. And, you know, even people in politics don't have time to go and research every single freaking candidate and what they stand for. But, you know, in a labor party, as we can see in other countries, they have what's called a manifesto. And that's, you know, that's the policies that every candidate adopts. So when you go to the ballot box and you have everybody from the dog catcher to the president there, and they have labor next to their name, you already know what they stand for. And we have like a unified like vision. And obviously that's simplifying things. But I have yet to meet a construction worker here in Austin, Texas, who is not like the sound of having a labor party. It's a hit. Yeah. And at no point did I mention communism or anything like that. And I don't think that should be a boogeyman word. I do think it's important to build relationships with people before like dropping the C word. Yeah. You know, I've learned that the hard way. But like I said, at this point, for better or for worse, people know I'm a communist. And the thing that I think in my, if I'm thinking about it from a positive perspective, yeah, I'm a communist and people know I'm a communist, but they know me as Nicole, and they know what I do. And most of these workers like totally dig what I'm doing, you know, as an organizer. They know I stand for workers unapologetically, and I'm not trying to, I don't know. Like, the frustrating thing to me, like on a personal note, frustrating with myself, is like I can hardly remember a time when I thought communism was a bad thing. So it's like I wish that I like kept a diary so I could go back when I was first learning about it, so I could like revisit my attitude. It's hard for me to like get in the head of somebody who is suspicious of it, you know. But back to the like the positive way of looking at it, if they didn't know I was a communist, they might think that I'm a liberal, or they might think that, you know, whatever. But if we're ever gonna like associate communism with something positive, then we have to put that label on ourselves at some point. Or just like secret communists all the time, then communism is still the bad guy. And
right. And I think there's something to be said. Like, if we're open and honest about who we are and what we stand for, that really demystifies a lot of the old, you know, the 100-year-old Red Scare talking points of like, oh, they want to take your toothbrush and all other fun stuff.
Exactly. I could not agree more. If we're like super secretive about it the whole time. And it's just part of my personality. I am an oversharer, and, you know, there's no way I could hide the fact that I'm a communist. I am honest about, like, every part of myself, you know, my warts and all. I'm a working class woman. Yeah, it's just not in my nature to, like, hide any part about me. And I'm the kind of person that welcomes debate. I like debating people. What I like is, like, if, you know, people know I'm a communist, they got questions about it, or they're like, what about this? What about that? Well, that starts a conversation about it, and that's how I have changed my mind, you know, in every circumstance. So
personal frustrations with being a communist is, like, you need to know everything. Like, what did Marx do on his 18th birthday? I don't know. You're going to tell me. And it's going to be something ridiculous, and I want to be like, okay, that's cool. Let's talk about some actual stuff. Or, you know, Stalin bribed the clouds to not rain or kill 20 billion people. And those are the things that we got to deal with all the time. It's just like, no, can we just not talk about, like, as a historian, can we not talk about history for once? That'd be great.
Well, one thing that I heard, you know, one of my union brothers really likes to listen to Joe Rogan. And so I found myself listening to, and this is one of the union members that I've talked about socialism and communism with. Cornel West was on Joe Rogan. Cornel West was talking about socialism, communism. He was like, oh, do you listen to Joe Rogan? Do you know this guy, Cornel West? Have you listened to this? And, you know, and so I listened to the podcast with Cornel West on it, and, you know, he's a brilliant guy, obviously not, you know, his approach to communism is maybe not as in line with how I think about communism.
He needs some work.
Yeah. Well, there's so many things I respect about Cornel West. It's frustrating listening to him talk about
communism. We'll throw a few books at him with love.
Yeah, I know. That's the thing that I was just like, I don't want to come off as arrogant. I'm not trying to say I'm as smart as Cornel West, but yeah, I wish that, and I think about this every time I like listen to NPR too, is like they think NPR says they like have all the views on NPR and they talk to everybody, but I've never heard them talk to a single Marxist. And I've never, if they like, they want to have all these like negative shows about China, I never hear anybody from the Communist Party from China speak on their program. And that's like, you know, I'm like singling out NPR right now, but it's really every American sort of like mainstream media is like they want to criticize communism and Marxism, but they never actually have like communists or Marxists like defending them. Or defending, you know, what we talk about or what we
believe. Right, or if they do, it's some expatriate from back in the olden days that are like, oh, my family.
We're in a famine, yeah. You know, and it's like as if famines are like unique to communist countries.
Yeah, it's always some person who came from an ex-communist country or someone else. Like, oh, I fled the terror. Like, okay, can we talk to someone else here? Because, like, you know, they're... Yeah. Even if they're from China, like that is one person of 1.5 billion people. 1.5 billion-ish.
But for all of the things that Dr. West talked about, you know, that were problematic about communism, one thing that really resonated with me that he said about the United States is, and this is not verbatim, but he was talking about all this like negative like associations with the United States. How, you know, we always bring up all this negative stuff, like, you know, Trump. Or, you know, slavery or genocide or whatever. And he made the point that the things that we love about the United States, you know, like the music, like hip hop and jazz and rock and blues and the food and the art and the sports and things that we love about this country are just as American as Trump is. Artists that we love. I think he was using like, Mary J. Blige is a woman that he brought up. Mary J. Blige is just as American as Trump is. And we can take that analogy and describe communism with that too. It's just, I'm a communist and I'm just as much a product or a part of the communist project as Stalin was or as Mao was, or, you know, the peasants in Vietnam that pick rice, or in the Philippines. Those communists are just as important to our tradition as any of these, like, you know, historical figures in communist history. So
it's a shared narrative.
Communism is not just Stalin. You know, there are millions of people who believe in communism and have been a part of it, and it is unfortunate that a lot of the conversation about communism is just, like, focused on, like, just a handful of individuals when I don't think we celebrate the masses enough, you know. When I say masses, it's kind of a little bit triggering to me. I think that, like, term is way overused.
Oh, yeah.
Unfortunately, but yeah, we just don't talk about
the everyday person.
Everyday communists. Yeah. So anyway, it's being a communist, being an open communist, it is what it is, and I make the best of it. And in some ways, it's been difficult, but in other ways, it's like, it's not ever going to be, I think in my lifetime, it's never going to be easy to be a communist in the United States, but somebody's got to be out. Yeah, so it's just, it is what it is. I don't know, like, if I were to do it over again, I don't think I can just change who I am. Even if I were to do it over again, it maybe would have been under different types of circumstances, but I would still be an open communist, and every opportunity I can to, like, point out the things that people are positive, I try to point out that they're communist. Maybe the thing I just want to end with is, you know, I'm a relatively new member of the party. I came to communism a few years ago. I wish that I would have known about the party, you know, 3 years ago. It's so far been the most welcoming and relatable, like, left space that I've ever been around. You know, I was talking about my my union meetings initially being retirement home, but I love having elders around. One thing that I was always kind of wondering in all the other left spaces I've been in is, like, where are the old people to, you know, ask about, or, like, where are the old wise people?
What is to be done?
Angsty young people. Yeah. And, you know, the answer is they're in the CP. And I just so far have not met a single person in the Communist Party that I just am not totally delighted by. And I'm just like, I love the fact that there are so many members who are part of unions and are, like, leaders in their unions. And that just fills me with a lot of excitement. It's like, finally I've found a space where I feel comfortable, like, being who I am and being in a left space. And I really, like, genuinely had never felt that way before in other left organizations. So it's a place that I feel like I can bring my coworkers around and they're not going to be, like, weirded out or alienated. So I'm just, I'm excited to be a member, and I look forward to the future being a member.
Wonderful. Well, thanks for talking. Thanks for doing this. You know, we had a nice long talk, and if anyone else listening wants to learn more about unions, about what they've done, what our role has been in them, feel free to reach out to the party. We'll add some notes at the end, some contact information. And until next time, solidarity forever.
Would you have freedom from wage slavery and come join the grand industrial band? How would you from misery and hunger be free? Come on, do you share land to hand? There is power in a band working folk when we stand hand in hand. That's the power that must rule in every land. One industrial union brand. Oh, would you have mansions of gold in the
sky and live in a shack that's away in the back. Oh, would you have wings up in heaven to fly and start here with a rag on your back? But there is power in a band working folk when we stand hand in hand. That's a power that must rule in every land. One industrial union brand. Oh, if you like sluggers to feed in your head, don't organize, all union despise. If you want nothing before you are dead, shake hands with your boss and look wise. But there is power in a band of working folk when we stand hand in hand. That's a power that must rule in every land, one industrial union brand. So come all ye workers from every land and come join the grand industrial band. Then we our share of this earth shall demand. Come on, do your share, lend a hand.